way of explanation, after I've been there for a week or two, I found myself as the rigger detail for duty crew with an engine fitter called Dolly Gray. He was an old sweat. And the day before our duty day, which involved handling any visiting aircraft, we were to relieve that day's duty crew at lunchtime so that they could get a meal. And so it meant to make a late meal for us with just about time to get a cup of tea in the naffy before it closed. While sitting in the canteen with Dolly Gray, Ginger Reynolds, another sprog fitter 2A, came in to tell us that we were to report to station headquarters with him and several others. At station headquarters we were told that we were going to RAF Kirkham shortly to take a special aircraft course, have 28 days embarkation leave, and then go overseas to a squadron equipped with the type of aircraft on which we had completed this special course. We spent the next few days back in the hangars, during which time I did get involved a bit more than previously, and then were given a 40-hour pass before proceeding to Kirkham. I remember going home for that weekend and telling my mother that I was going on the course, but didn't say too much about the overseas part of the story. An uncle had died just before this, and the funeral took place whilst I was at home, so there was enough grief without adding to my mother's anxiety. The train journey from Andover to London and then on to Preston, etc., was the usual wartime excursion, with most of the passengers being in uniform. I remember on the London to Preston leg finding that a lot of the RAF bods on the train were all going to Kirkham, and that rations were provided from large cardboard boxes. Corned beef sandwiches and some fruit were shared, but nothing to drink. By the time we got to the railway station nearest to our RAF Kirkham, it was dark. We were duly fell in threes and marched up to the camp, humping our kit bags, etc., with the leading right-hand man carrying a white hurricane lamp and a red by the rear man. The hutted accommodation on the dispersed site was hardly completed, but we found beds and collected blankets. But before we went to bed, we started on the programme of vaccination, inoculation, etc., and the next day collected overseas kit. That day we were also allowed to post home any surplus personal stuff and were told that there was no course and no leave, but we would be moving off to a port of embarkation next day. In fact, within about 36 hours of arriving at Kirkham, we were loaded onto a merchant ship called the Cape Hawk in Liverpool, with all sorts of rumours concerning our destination. The last opportunity to write home came that afternoon, and we set sail about dusk. I was volunteered by a warrant officer later found to be called Connors, and a splendid character too, with a couple of others to start on the spud bashing fatigue. This task was undertaken on deck, so we were able to watch Liverpool recede into the distance as the mountain of potatoes diminished on the 9th of February 1942. Accommodation on board was in the holds, with hammocks slung at night, providing a minimum amount of space to allow access, provided everyone took his turn preparing for bed. Most of the space was taken up by mess tables with fixed seating. We were about 120 strong, including a few senior NCOs and three or four sergeant pilots. Later on, we were to find that there were also some officers aboard, all pilots, except for Squadron Leader Shorty Hughes, who was an engineer officer, and a wonderful leader, as we were to find out in the weeks to come. The senior officer was a Wing Commander McLean DFC, who I think was a New Zealander. And after a week or so at sea, he and Shorty got us all together on a hatch cover to tell us what we were setting out to achieve. In the holds below those we lived in were 16 Spitfires in crates and sufficient tools and equipment to assemble them and to take them by aircraft carrier to within flying range of Malta as the first batch of Spitfires to operate as fighters outside of the United Kingdom. Photographic reconnaissance Spits had operated abroad, but those we were concerned with turned out to be Mark V's with a mixed armament of 20mm cannon and machine guns. If all went well, we would fly off the aircraft, return to Gibraltar, and await a convoy back to UK. Home in 6 weeks, they said. So the Special Operations Maintenance Party, or SOMP, was to be in existence for a short time only, it seemed. To enlarge on my other notes referring to the assembly of the Spitfires at Gibraltar and their subsequent dispatch from carriers to Malta, the following memories might be of interest. SS Cape Hawk moved alongside the Keen, which I believe was known as the Inner Harbour at Gib, on the 21st of February 1942. Also tied up alongside the Keen was the aircraft carrier HMS Eagle. The 16 crates were offloaded and lined up on the quayside. The need to exercise strict security was recognised. German spies were interested in all that could be seen from vantage points across the bay in Algeciras, etc. Spanish labour, which was always considered suspect, employed anywhere on the Rock, had to leave their places of work and make their way to the frontier to be across into Spain before dusk, and were not allowed back onto the Rock until after dawn next day. Incidentally, they were thought to be well off for food, etc., compared with the rest of the Spanish people, in that they had access to what was available in shops, etc., on the Rock. Nevertheless, I did see them foraging among swill bins later on. We understood that they were allowed to take a limited amount of food back over the border each day, which included two loaves of white bread, one of which had to be sliced, presumably to ensure that it didn't stay fresh too long. Even stale bread was sought after, so fresh as was at a premium. A large proportion of the Gibraltarian population had been evacuated to England, especially those not in essential employment, and those remaining were thought to be loyal. As a result of this security situation, no work on the crates was to be undertaken in daylight. But as soon as darkness fell on February the 22nd, we were detailed off to start and prepare to open each crate in turn. The crates were of solid wooden construction with steel straps leading to slinging points at roof level. The ends of the crates were secured by a number of coach bolts accessible from wooden covers nailed to the crate. These covers were carefully removed and retained. The end of the crate was then removed to provide access to the dismantled aircraft, and then sufficient of the aircraft bits and pieces were removed to allow us to reach the bolts, securing the cradle on which the aircraft fuselage was mounted to the floor of the crate. At this point, a Coles crane was positioned to pick up slings attached to the lifting points of the crate at roof level and towards the open end of the crate. A controlled lift by the Coles crane driver, who was Royal Air Force, tilted the crate, pivoted about the end farthest away from the open end, so that a brave Irk could get underneath the crate to help slacken the cradle bolts, which were then removed from inside the crate. The Irk would then escape, and the crate lowered back onto its base. The Health and Safety at Work Act became law much later. Any equipment, etc., that had been removed was then restowed in the crate, the end closed up, and the access covers replaced. Any rubbish or other evidence of activity was tidied up, so that by next morning, when the local labour came in, the 16 crates were in precisely the same position and condition as seen at cease work the day before. By dusk on the 23rd, we were able to start work again on the quayside, commencing with the removal of the ends of the crates previously worked on. The Coles crane was used to help slide the fuselage out on its cradle, and the bolts securing the fuselage to the cradle were then removed. The crane then lifted the fuselage on a sling, pivoting on the tailwheel, until a trestle could be positioned just after the engine bulkhead, and the fuselage was then lowered onto the trestle. The main planes with supporting wooden frames were manhandled from the crate and positioned adjacent to the fuselage, stripped of their supporting woodwork, and again manhandled into position to allow a minimum number of the root end bolts to be inserted to secure the main plane to the fuselage. With main planes secured, the undercarriage uplocks were open, the undercarriage lowered and locked down. No attempt was made at this stage to complete the assembly of systems, etc. The crane would now take the weight, the trestle taken away, so that the partly assembled aircraft would be moved to a point where the flight deck crane on HMS Eagle could hoist the Spitfire aboard onto the flight deck. Remember, this activity was taking place at night, but with a generous amount of lighting, as Gib wasn't blacked out until an alert was sounded. However, the lighting on the flight deck was kept to a minimum, particularly when the loads reached flight deck level. The bulk of the carrier shielded activity on the quayside, and when the Spitfire and or its subsequent load of bits and pieces needed to complete the assembly were lifted more into view, the Fleet Air Arm boys arranged some activity on the flight deck, e.g. ground running hurricanes, to camouflage the genuine bustle. As each aircraft reached the flight deck, it was then pushed onto the lift and taken below, or struck down, to the hangar deck. Its associated items followed, having been lifted from the quayside on a large pallet on wheels. These associated items included the propeller, tailplanes, rudder, elevators, armament, fairings, a 90-gallon drop tank, etc. As each aircraft crate was emptied, all evidence of disturbance was again erased and the site left as it ceased work. During that night of the 23rd, 24th, of February, we had uncrated and moved 12 aircraft onto Eagle, having spent the day of the 23rd moving stores and ammunition. During the day of the 24th, we moved from Cape Hawke onto Eagle, and during the night of the 24th, 25th, got the remaining four aircraft uncrated and aboard Eagle by the early hours of the 25th. We then went to sleep on safari beds on the hangar deck under the aircraft. These beds were lightweight metal frames about 2 feet wide and 6 feet long when assembled, over which had been secured a canvas cover. The frame was mounted on four metal cross members, which provided about 3 inches clearance from the deck. The cross members were detachable, and when not in use, the whole lot rolled up into a cylindrical shape, 3 feet long, 9 inches in diameter, rather like a camp bed. We had a pair of blankets, each supplied by Royal Navy stores, as were the beds. During this period, we had been introduced to Royal Naval routine, shown to our mess decks, and served Royal Navy meals. All rather different to the Royal Air Force, and our experience on Cape Hawke served only as a very inadequate introduction, really. We started to pick up naval jargon from members of the crew and from the pipes broadcast over the ship's tannoy. Jolly Jack was usually a very helpful character, and the Royal Marines, whose bandsman provided the hangar guard come fire picket, soon became quite well known to us. Among our number was an ex-Marine, Harry Parry, who soon found how to scrounge a tot, although we were not issued with rum as were the majority of the ship's company. Cook of the mess was a daily duty, where each mess table provided one man to collect meals from the galley and supervise the sharing out of bulk quantities. He cleaned up after meals and carried the can if during rounds by the officer of the watch things were not in order. He also took orders for goods from the ship's canteen, as we were allowed to buy 20 cigarettes and a bar of nutty, that's chocolate, each day at a very low cost. When going ashore, we had to use the Liberty boat, even though we were tied up alongside the quay. This involved a close inspection by the officer of the watch to ensure a high standard of turnout. This was very difficult for us to achieve, as we had only one suit of blue, having exchanged the other for khaki drill at Kirkham, which had to be worn at that time of year. As we had no overalls, our blues were a bit scruffy after 10 days or more on the Cape Hawke, plus our more recent activities. Coming back on board after a run ashore included the mandatory requirement to salute as you came over the brow, and heaven help anyone caught failing to do so by the officer of the watch or his senior rate who were in attendance at the head of the gangplank.